The alternative to innovation is not stability, it's stagnation.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Fred Smith. He's the former head of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which he's the emeritus head of now, and he runs the Center for Advancing Capitalism. Fred, thanks for talking to us.
Always glad to be with you, Nick.
The Center for Advancing Capitalism, this is the mission statement. It engages both business people and free market intellectuals in the fight for liberty by building doer-thinker alliances. Through research, writing events, and other outreach activities, the center works to recapture for capitalism the moral legitimacy it has always merited. Let's start with basics. How are you defining capitalism in this context?
Capitalism, defined in many, many ways, and of course, originally invented the term, partly invented by his critics, right. Marx and so forth. Capitalism, I think, is best defined as an extensive system of voluntary arrangements between parties, embedded in the institutions of liberty, that is, extensive and involving property rights, voluntary agreements that allow people to reach a wide array and growing array of contractual obligations.
So, partly it's the economic application of classical liberal principles of autonomy.
Well, not just economics. Yeah. Arguably, it could be any kind of arrangements out there.
Okay.
But it's essentially, the classic examples are risk-sharing arrangements. And as we know, and certainly Reason has done a lot of work on, today's world, we're never going to be adults under the FDA rules because we're not allowed to say, I'm willing to assume risk. You sign those papers when you get operated on. I had two knee replacements. Mm-hmm. But let me assure you, look at those papers, and you know it says, no matter what happens, you're not going to do anything. Well, trial lawyers have learned years ago you can run a truck through those kind of rules.
What are the actors and who are some of the actors that have dragged capitalism's reputation into the gutter? And talk about, you know, how do we know that capitalism does not have a moral legitimacy? Or is capitalism, you know, if you talk to a leftist, they're like, holy cow, everywhere I see capitalism is winning throughout the world. Globalization has increased ownership, you know, has increased private ownership around the world. So what's going on?
Well, polling data suggests that in the United States and Europe, the original areas where capitalism broke out, very large numbers of people do not find capitalism an acceptable system. They think something better exists out there. They're not sure what it is, and certainly it's not socialism very often, at least in the United States, somewhat more in Europe. The general argument is that capitalism is a good idea, but, and then dot, dot, dot. And you end up with all the variant hyphenated capitalism. Inclusive capitalism,
state capitalism, crony capitalism
with a human face,
I'm a big fan of that. But what is it? You know, when you look at somebody like Donald Trump, who's everywhere right now, and he's a capitalist. He says he's a capitalist, and he's a bully, and he's a blowhard, and he lies about his net wealth. Is that where capitalism loses crowd support?
Trump has always been in the on the edge of the market economy, working with the political system. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, if you're a developer in urban America, state, any large politicized jurisdiction, the deal making with your partner on the other side, the so-called public-private partnerships, is a way of life. It's inevitable with government as big as it is, there would be interaction between business and the political system. The tragedy is so often it leads to subsidies, rent-seeking, the kind of aberrations which essentially discredit capitalism.
So, okay, and then there's people like Martin Shkreli, the pharmaceutical company executive who jacked up the cost of a pill.
Yeah.
Is he responsible for a bad face of capitalism, or is he a good capitalist?
Well, I think, in a way, those are the aberrations we center on. But if you look at the history, there's a book by Jerry Muller I just finished reading. It's a history of sort of philosophical attitudes towards capitalism since the Greeks onward. And you see that every criticism of capitalism you can imagine, it alienates man from man. It turns humans into robots in the workplace. It destroys our ability to enjoy the aesthetic, non-economic.
It destroys the physical planet. It takes from the poor and gives to the rich.
And cultural, and it undermines the cultural traditions. The challenge, in a way, is we have a whole intellectual tradition going way back, but certainly exacerbated after the progressives came into power in the late 19th century, which essentially creates capitalism as, at best, an instrumental, immoral, amoral way of advancing wealth and knowledge. Distributes it badly, doesn't handle it very well, creates inappropriate, it uses means rather than focusing on the ends of the good society.
Right.
You have both on the right and the left criticism, capitalism go back.
Right.
That affects the culture, and culture has a massive effect. Culture essentially is the ocean, the atmosphere in which we all breathe and swim, and the result is whole generations of America have grown up in a, yes, it's okay, but.
Right.
And our side has spent most of our energies, the free market intellectuals, which start emerging really in the late post-Boer War period, 48, one Republican society, Reason 68.
Yeah, the Libertarian Party 71, Cato
CI 84, yeah. And then a whole plethora, and another in America around the world at the state level.
Right.
But late, and our focus following Hayek's dictum was to fight the war of ideas. In better words, aim our intellectual and moral arguments against our opponents in the intellectual left. One of the groups who is the most difficult to convert or even persuade, because the self-interest of intellectuals, as Schumpeter and others have pointed out, is statism. They get moral superior, they capture the moral high ground. You care about money and things in business, we care about people. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as the state grows, the role for well-paid, powerful advisors, not only in government, but in business. Every business now is sort of a mirror image. Environmental Protection Agency, Vice President for Environmental Affairs. Human Resources Areas, Vice President for Human, and on and on and on. Intellectuals benefit from the state, and that makes their intellectual bias reinforced, and so they're, it's not that we can't persuade us. Many of us were lefties at one time, but boy, it's an uphill battle.
So what is the moral case for capitalism, or what is the moral legitimacy of capitalism?
Well, first then, this is one that all of us more or less focus in on. It's most compatible with liberty. It's a voluntary system. Nobody is coerced to buy from a firm, to work for a firm, to supply to a firm, to invest in a firm. That is an attribute that means that we are essentially creating plebiscites every day where you want to work, where you want to buy from, and so on. And that illustrates that the market, in a very, very real sense, is one of the most democratic moral institutions you can have, because it expresses the will of the people in the society.
Now, but is it also is it distinct from a pragmatic or a utilitarian case? So somebody like Joseph Schumpeter said, you know, that it allowed people to kind of take goods and distribute them more fairly. It's that it was constantly creating more and more goods at cheaper and cheaper prices. And he used the example that, you know, it's not that it produced silk stockings for a queen, but rather the factory girls who made the stockings could afford them themselves.
Right. It democratized the consumer society.
So, I mean, is the moral case clearly distinct from a kind of pragmatic case that, because a lot of leftists, and certainly this was true throughout most of the Cold War, they would say, well, you know what, you know, actually capitalism, it produces more blue jeans, more cars, better colleges, et cetera.
Better, yeah, we win the war on utilitarian grounds. Mm. But utilitarian grounds, of course, are just one of the core values that anthropologists talk about have evolved through man's history. We don't extend those values in other ways. For example, we have Adam Smith II, The Wealth of Nations, which illustrates just how incredibly creative the voluntaristic system is in creating spontaneous order, creating this web of cooperative networks that extends throughout the world, where people have no idea what the ultimate end of their product is, nonetheless contribute to a pencil and many other things out there. But they failed to, or we've failed, I think, to date, to adequately, although we've done it intellectually, to adequately understand that as people, we're social animals. Adam Smith wrote another book, A Theory of Moral Sentiments, which said, yes, we're self-interested, a very powerful way, a survival instinct that had to exist, but we're also other-regarding, empathetic. Why? Because as social animals, how do we ever get to... Mm-hmm. We have to, in some sense, put ourselves in the skins, in the minds of other people, if we're going to engage in society. And man is a social animal. We're not like tigers who can't get along with each other, although libertarians might be more in that camp. But we generally are speaking as we're social animals, which means we do have an empathetic sense. And Adam Smith wrote eloquently about that. You're walking down the street, a guy trips, you sort of wince. That means, in effect, that in our business conversations, the economic linkages that we create, I see as a massive template, a trellis, as it were, to allow humans to interact on a limited, incorporate on economic grounds. But in so doing, no business conversation for an hour is not going to involve what do you do, what are your interests are, what are your families, what are your hobbies.
So who are
that creates a social linkage, not economic linkage, mm-hmm. and those social networks extend outside the firm. And so the market not only creates a web of involuntary economic reactions, it is the best facilitator for creating the rich social networks that encompass the modern world.
Where does charity or philanthropy or non-profit-driven activity fall into this, and what is the proper scope within a business to do that? So, and are there businesses that you think do a good job of delivering quality goods at high prices with you know fantastic service, but then also serve the community in a way that is not you know simply kind of cheap PR, or does that matter if it's PR?
It does matter, and I think the distinction between what a company should be doing and what companies feel they're told they have to do and then are sort of morally blackmailed into doing is very distinctive. Mm-hmm. A corporation is a special, the corporation incidentally is the one where most of the fire is driven.
Right.
Capitalism is sort of this amorphous system and people say, well, that works,
but it's the
chief institution. Yeah. Nader doesn't mind capitalism, he hates corporations, okay? The corporation is the main institution that most people see when they see capitalism. There's other institutions, partnerships, private companies and so on. But they see the corporation as somehow an impersonal big force that is distorting. But the corporation is not, operates with internally as one of the most cooperative endeavors out. No company, no good manager wants to do anything other than good relations with their customers, their employees, their investors, their suppliers. Now they can fail at that.
Has this always been true, or I mean, because you know, one of the things we're taught in history is, Carnegie is calling in the Pinkertons to shoot his striking miner. So is that actually, does that story have to be proven?
Well, it has to be proven one, and you know, the muckraker tradition is again. That was what I learned about early capitalism, too. Remember, we learned about the monopolies and the trust and how they were riding roughshod over. And then later on, we find out that the prices are dropping faster in the trust areas, more and more immaterial is being available. Mankind organized and delivered the fruits of capitalism, the utilitarian value of capitalism, forms corporations, sometimes a very, very large one. Managing any large institution is a difficult situation, and often there are aberrations which make it hard. But good management is always striving for good. You don't want to antagonize any of your economic cooperatives. You can avoid it. And to do that, you have to be thinking about what they want to do. Now, it doesn't mean you have unlimited responsibilities for the world. The idea, the leftist idea, the social justice idea, you're responsible for everything, is a recipe for disaster, because profits are an incredibly important way of creating a North Star, a metric that helps you sort through. Well, maybe a better lighting for the workers, or maybe higher pay, or maybe the suppliers would need more early payments, or maybe my investors would want to know more reporting of what my investment schedule is for the next thing. There's tremendous things that you can spend your residual money on. Profits, in a very difficult way, says think of all the opportunities you have to invest, to deal with one of your cooperators to make the relationship more cooperative and so on, and then try to figure it out. Good managers are better at that than bad managers, people in the business world who do that well. But all of that is limited by the fact that it's to improve your overall ability, because you think you're doing good things, to be sustainable, to be sustainably profitable.
Right.
Survival is important if you believe you're doing a moral thing.
And so in this case, I mean, part of the of advancing an understanding of capitalism and its legitimacy is also to say that businesses are not responsible for every aspect of human life.
And they can't be.
Right.
Because once, now it doesn't mean that another institution couldn't be formed to do something else.
No, I mean, whether it's a nonprofit or a church or even a government program.
And capitalism, by creating greater wealth and knowledge, makes the viability of those other non-economic institutions much better. But when you start blurring the distinction between the two, you lose the metric. You're a top manager in a Fortune 500 company, and you've decided you're going to be socially responsible. Well, first of all, you're not very sure what that means, but you look around, you're not an expert in sociology or human welfare and so on. You read the newspaper and it says the cause this year is AIDS, or the cause this year is African poverty, or maybe it's childhood pregnancy, or thousands of injuries. You're going to be influenced as much as anything, but what your cocktail party people have said, why aren't you doing something about, or your kid comes home from school and says, Daddy, why are you destroying the planet? The thousands of social clues that have nothing to do with your expertise or your capability. The idea that a corporation should abandon its specialized role, which is an incredible essential element of a capitalist system, and become a general purpose organization, that's what governments are. And nobody thinks governments are doing a very good job of delivering their attempts to be everything to everyone.
Right. You know, an increasing number of people, when you look at polls at Pew or Gallup or everybody who does them, shows an increasing number of people really think that the system the system, life, is rigged against them, that business is rigged against them. Are they, you know, in the wake of the financial bailouts, where some people got made completely whole or even more than whole, other people got nothing? You know, they got the shaft, but, you know, from policies they had no control over but ended up screwing up their lives and their jobs. Are people wrong to think that the system is rigged?
Well, the system is rigged in a certain way. But they're wrong to pick the wrong criminal. Mm-hmm. The basic argument is markets should be allowed to be free to operate, and they should, that means free to operate and free to fail. Mm-hmm. What we've created, and this is an inevitable political process, it's always trying to protect the past. It's trying to protect the vested interest, the powerful interest, the business of the past. Government, to a large extent, the instincts are to help people in place and in job skills. So they're always trying to help the buggy industry of yesterday, and the innovative industry of tomorrow is sort of scary to them. It's disruptive. They're not plugged into the system.
So then the exemplary case of this right now is something like Uber,
yeah.
Where you have a new system that is voluntary, that people love, regulates itself, and the first action is to try and save taxi systems that were in place in the
20s. Incidentally, one of the interesting things is, that's the other part, is the internally corporations want to be cooperative. Externally, competition is the force that continuously makes them think, are we doing the right things? And they can see that in their profit margins, their customers disappearing, higher worker turnover. There's plenty of ways that competition disciplines the business community in a way far more effectively than a political process.
But does it also discipline then, and you hear this, and people, you know, we joke about it in the kind of libertarian world, like, I'm going to discipline that guy with the market by not going there. It also disciplines workers who don't have skills, and it might be because they're lazy, but it might be because they're just not up to the task. What happens then to people who are disciplined into poverty by the market?
That's one way of putting it. Another way of putting it is that the economy, like the ecology, is a dynamic process. Mm-hmm. Trees are always dying, and certain skill sets, certain capital equipment, certain sectors of the economy are always fading out, dying out. You can try to stop that process. You can try to keep the old trees alive forever, and in the process you suppress the growth of the only hope we have for the future. The alternative to innovation is not stability, it's stagnation. And as bad as the disruptive effects that are certainly present in a dynamic capitalist
right.
economy, the alternative is the stagnation you saw in the planned economy.
Yeah, I would hope nobody would say, yeah, you know, in order to preserve X number of taxi cabs, Uber is banned.
Well, banned.
You know, some people tried.
They're banned
it.
In Austin.
They have in some places, but overwhelmingly, Uber figured out a way to sue for peace. But, you know, with workers who are displaced by economic disruption and innovation, creative destruction, what is a way that from a capitalist point of view, from a libertarian, from a market-friendly point of view, that we can help ease those transitions without stopping the process which is absolutely necessary to improve living standards?
What capitalism does is empower people. It empowers people to think not only about today, but about their future. People go to college even though they know that period is not going to be economically productive.
Right.
People go to work at startup jobs, at McDonald's and so forth, not because they want to stay there, but because it gives them certain skills that then equip them to take other jobs elsewhere. Markets are about good relations with the worker. But markets, some markets especially, mining towns and so forth, the understanding is that's a short-term position,
right.
Or financial industry.
Yeah.
There are some brilliant kids who go into the financial world and they burn out in 10 years.
Right.
And most of them know the history now is replete with people that they earn a lot of money, they learn some job skills, and then they go into something else for the
right.
rest of their life. A dynamic economy means work skills, whatever your work skills are today, they're not going to be the work skills you need tomorrow. Capitalism is making that more and more apparent to people, but not surprisingly, some people,
right.
traditionalist value, but also unions and so forth, want to freeze the present.
Mm-hmm.
But if you freeze the present, you kill off the future. And in a world where young people are continuously being born and where older industries are stagnating, the only hope for most people in the world, and certainly outside the United States, all the people in the world, is to continuously create new opportunities, new innovations, the Ubers of the future.
So talk a little bit about the specific sorts of activities and arguments that you know that the center is participating in and that you you think will be able to change people's understanding? I mean, do we need to make it more explicit and more persuasive the argument that you're just making,
which is that— we have to translate it into, look, the problem with policy wonks is we're wonky, okay?
Right.
We have to find a way of taking our academic, and remember the problem is some of our best intellectuals are in the university system, and you don't get paid for talking to people in those places. You get paid for writing abstract articles with lots of mathematics that appear in non-readable journals and non-representative places. None of that is useful in reaching out to our potential allies in the capitalist system, the businessmen, the capitalists themselves. We need to find a way of taking our intellectual ammunition, which is good, and reformat it, recalibrate it, going from nuclear bomb theory to, you know, 22 round small caliber material.
I think you might be losing people who are squirrely about guns. So talk about
we need to recalibrate our arguments so they reach the people we need to have as allies. That means businessmen, and then in a way that can reach their workers, their suppliers. Every business needs a story about why they're not only proud to be businessmen doing what they do, but why they feel that their operation actually is good for society. And workers should understand that, their suppliers, their investors should, because those people who are economic cooperators need to be, in a sense, non-economic ambassadors.
Are there certain businesses or businessmen or writers that are doing this well, and what can we learn from them?
I wish I could tell you there's a massive underemployed resource out there. I don't think there is. Most businessmen are pragmatic. Schumpeter said this. He said, wait a minute, we're producing goods and services, we're providing jobs, so on. Isn't that enough? No, it's not. The utilitarian arguments are good for the first century, I would say. The first century of capitalism, 1770s till 1850s, pretty good in Europe and the United States. But then the people started raising, what about the other non-economic values? And we all know those exist, and they're important for our lives. They're naturally important for others. And we never really went and generalized the arguments. One of the challenges of our movement, and there are people who do that, but we haven't done it in a way that moves it out of the conceptual sphere into the kind of thing you can talk at a bar stool. You think you can go to a cocktail party and the businessman can blow the hell out of his liberal academic friend.
So what about, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, various people over time, and Conrad Hilton, the hotelier, wrote a very popular speech in the late 50s about why he opened, he was attacked by right-wingers and by anti-communists. He opened a hotel in Moscow. And he gave this great speech that was like, well, what I'm doing it there is I'm destroying them, because when they see what we can provide. So things like that. Is that getting towards what you're looking for?
But the problem, well, let's take Mackey. Mackey's, anyways, a very admirable businessman. He runs an admirable place and so on. But conscious capitalism suggests that capitalism needs to do more. I mean, he doesn't say that, but it's sort of suggested. One of my friends, Martin Summers in England, wrote a piece called Conscious Capitalism is not totally without merit, but what we really are failing to realize is unconscious capitalism, the equivalent in the non-economic sphere of the spontaneous order, that capitalism creates this template for our much richer social networks. It makes people more considerate of others. It enhances our empathetic senses, because you're not going to be a good businessman unless you have an ability to read the other. The very concept of he's a good person to do business with means you didn't walk away from that with 99% of the gains. You didn't walk away saying, boy, I skinned that guy. There are people who do that in the business world. They're called sharp dealers. And they're not considered the kind of people you want to do business with. The business community, the existence of the modern corporation is a force for making mankind more cooperative and more disciplined. Competition makes it more disciplined. The nature of the firm and its incentive structure makes it more outreach.
As somebody who has a checkered history as a government regulator, are there times when even good capitalists just are not like that, where they're like, well, screw it, I'm dumping all of my used chemicals into an open water supply? And if so, then what do we do then? Is there a role for non-market-generated regulation of business and business practices?
Well, first let's look at the question of why would anyone dump? They would not have dumped their trash, tank load in your backyard, because it's private property. What we have done, and the progressives really in a genius.
No, but the rivers were never owned. The Hudson River was never.
No. In England, in the early Industrial Revolution, fishermen had rights to fish along a river, and when the pollution started killing the fish, they went to court and won. The railroads, the farmers had a right to grow their crops. When the railroads started sparking and burning, this is all in early coast, okay, Ronald Coast. But what the government did, because these were now very powerful economic interests, they changed the law and changed the liability rules to effectively allow dumping of sparks, dumping of stuff in
so
the river.
So what do we do now then? Is it, I mean, do we go back to that? Or do we, you know, or I mean, I'm saying, what do we do moving forward, especially if we're trying to create a revolution where business is seen as morally legitimate, capitalism is morally legitimate?
Well, we have to, let's take the easiest example that I can think of is, the United States and the world have two important liquid underground resources. One is oil, which because of property rights expansion in the 18th, 17th century, allows subsurface ownership rights and mineral rights, okay? I own the land, I own the mineral rights, but I can sever the two, and I can sell an oil company.
Right.
Oil company buys this little piece, not very useful, but oil companies have every incentive to unitize it, create a pool, and then learn what's there and so forth. This last 2 weeks, you California groups would know this, you found a massive underground aquifer was found in the Central Valley of California. It was found, incidentally, because the oil industry has mapped almost all of the United States, and their data showed where the water reserve was. But nobody can own that reservoir today.
Right.
We have no subsurface mineral water rights to ownership. So they, and the vast amount of potable water on the planet is not rivers and lakes, it's groundwater. If we could turn, if we could create a just an option, we don't have to turn it over tomorrow morning, but allow anyone in an area who can acquire property rights and then can say, we would like to own the aquifer. We've got local groups who own the underground, they're above the aquifer. We'd like to own that in here, so I plan to do it and manage it and so on. They would then have incentive not to dump pollution in that groundwater, that aquifer. They would have reason to try to replenish it more quickly when there was a rainfall. They would have reasons to utilize that water and price it so it was not wasted and so on. We failed to allow the market to move into areas. And because we didn't have them, we had no markets in those areas, the market didn't fail, the market was outlawed, then we have regulations coming, well, the market has failed, we have to do it. Much of the environmental issue, much of the electromagnetic spectrum where we ban the ownership of the electromagnetic waves, we can modify the law in resource area after resource area to allow groups under certain circumstances to petition the current political body owning that resource and managing that resource for privatization options. Say, we would like to own that. Here's why we think we'd do a good job. We'll submit an annual report. And then reopen the laboratory of markets to begin to show how markets can resolve these problems. Failing a property rights approach, we slip into market socialism, which is the Soviet Union tried for years.
You know, one of the things in the, you know, over the past 40 years, say, you know, going back to the early 70s, which we might say is the start of the official kind of doctrinaire libertarian movement, the focus has always, has really been on economics. And one of the things that you talk about here is that that can only take you so far. What is the role of culture and how do we work into that space?
Well, you have, of course, Virginia Pastrell did a very good job of moving us in that direction. And others have begun to do that. Deidre McCloskey obviously is moving us in that direction. We've got to do a lot more in that area, but we also have to tell it. Our narratives tend to be economic narratives. Ibn Bastiat's narratives, as provocative as they are, have not turned France into a libertarian haven. Somehow we have to reach, you know, the standard cliche, the hearts as well as the minds. But to do that, we need evocative stories. We need stories, and we've done some of these, stories about what the ban on genetically modified organisms has done to the hopes of African farmers. Mm-hmm. How in other countries like Brazil and Argentina, somewhat freer societies, GMOs now have revolutionized it. But a European elite's banning trade from African countries that use modern technology have condemned whole populations. There, our job should not be to tell the story in Washington or in London, but to bring the African voice more vocally to the surface. We could tell, I mean, we all know the power of the crying baby on television. Where are our understanding of how we tell stories that evoke the charitable responses, the empathetic responses of people? People are not opposed to capitalism. They are opposed to the caricature that has shown government in bed with government and and businesses playing games that are fraudulent games with corporate social responsibility.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking to Fred Smith, who ran the Competitive Enterprise Institute for so many years and so well, the Center for Advancing Capitalism, which is part of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Check it all out at CEI.org. For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.